Hey, 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 conscious leaders, a warm welcome today to yet another episode. You have now officially arrived to season two, where we are talking about building a fortified future and bringing trust back. And sometimes bringing trust back reminds us that we sometimes need to go back to our inner core and our inner revolution in order for us to really understand how we need to start trusting ourselves as human beings as we walk our journey in this lifetime. Today with me, I've got Dr. Sanne Ngedi with me. We are going to unpack her story of how she has fortified herself through a very, very traumatic story that crushed every bit of her being over the past few years. And I want to state that the story that will be shared with us today is for Sanne to share with other people that might be going through a midlife crisis or going through a stage in their life where it just seems like there is no hope. This story, I can assure you, will bring you hope. It will bring you an understanding that we all have something in common. And I'm absolutely privileged that I get to share the story on this platform with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen.
So something I think you and I have spoken about quite often is this thing called the 40s. That's why I call it the fortified future. Because I myself have also gone through my fortification and, you know, where everything that I possibly thought was going well did not end up so well in my life. And it's almost like the structures of your life breaks down, foundation gone, and now it's the inner renovation that needs to happen, this rebuild of your life. But also more importantly, it's finding this new foundation, putting up new windows and making the rooms look pretty and breaking down walls. That is what this journey is like. And every single person will go through this in their lives. And as a numerologist, those cycles are in nines. So they do come. It's called the rise and the fall. And you've just turned 40, but yours came a little bit earlier. I want to actually take it back where life was normal. You know, tell me about growing up. You know, what was your family like, your mom, also your culture? We'd love to know.
That piece about turning 40, it's so funny. Before I turned 40, whenever people would be like 39 and then they turn 40 and they'd say, oh, entering the fourth floor, I'd be like, oh, oh, can these people go again? And I promise you, my life has changed completely. So before I turned 40, I didn't understand what it would mean, but now I completely understand. So born and raised in Durban, all good things come from Durban. I must state that.
Yes.
And I think I had the privilege to be raised by parents who, during a difficult time in our country's history, they themselves came from difficult backgrounds, but really worked hard to build the life that they have. So my mother started off as somebody who was giving advice and then became a guidance counselor. And from becoming a guidance counselor, bought a recruitment agency and effectively built that up from the ground. So if you can imagine just social worker to guidance counselor to running a black-owned recruitment agency, I grew up with a vision of somebody who was fierce, somebody who broke boundaries. And in those situations, there are people in the family who are successful, who look after other people. And my mother was that person. So I was raised with lots of cousins. I was raised with my mother supporting other people. So part of my DNA is that, like, when you rise, you help other people along the way. And I think when I've had stumbling blocks, my mother's been the role model that I go to for advice. She's been the pillar of strength. So I count myself privileged for being raised by such a fierce woman, but also the lifestyle that my parents created and the strength that they've given me has told me that I can do difficult things, I can break boundaries, I can go into difficult environments that might not be suitable for me, but I can make those environments work.
I absolutely love it. And it sounds like she was really, like, in the spirit of Ubuntu, solving the problem of people not having jobs right there in the family, in the core of it. But we're going to get into your career journey as well. And I really want us to dive into your story and setting the stage. First of all, what was your pandemic story? Because everybody, some people have still not been able to get over the pandemic. What was your pandemic story?
So mine was pre-pandemic. So actually, before the pandemic hit, I was married. And the year before the pandemic hit, I spent that year grappling in my marriage, and we ended up separated. And we separated just before the pandemic started. So I think it's actually quite ironic that being in that space by myself was almost a rediscovery of myself during the pandemic, from having been married, living with my ex-husband, to now being with just my daughter and having to rediscover who I was outside of that, because no one gets married to get divorced. So I think that was my pandemic story. And I listen sometimes to how other couples either survived or didn't survive the pandemic. I don't know what would have happened to me, but I think that was the right story for me at that point in time.
Yeah, and it's such a probably a relief that you managed to do it beforehand and having time secluded almost to deal with that. But you know, through the research that we've been doing, it shows definitely there's 8 trigger points that leads into the, almost we call it a spiritual awakening, or you can call it the dark night of the soul. Mm-hmm. This, where everything, the rug gets pulled out underneath you. Mm-hmm. And one of them is menopause. Mm-hmm. And one of them is getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you, going through a divorce, you know, it's like a life that you've planned with somebody that you love. You've mm-hmm. created a family. I don't think we as a society realize how traumatic that experience is. Mm. Talk me through that.
I think for me, going through the divorce was mourning a life I had envisaged, you know. So you plan, like, when you grow up, you've got these like ducks that you must get in a row, the things that you must do. And in 2012, I was really excited to be getting married, doing my PhD, 2015, having my baby. So it kind of felt like life was absolutely perfect. So I think the anxiety that set in when my marriage wasn't working was, is everything falling apart? Am I a failure? And almost like an anxiety about, like, what will my life be now? And I think looking back, what these few years have done is forced me to think about, what life do I want to build now, as opposed to the dream that I was holding on to. Yeah, so it's shifted me into a space of being conscious about what I want to build for myself.
And what did you learn about yourself during divorce? I'm curious, because I always find, you know, you see so many different scenarios of what that journey looks like. And I mean, we'll get into your career shortly, but I'm sure that you have many people that you have to deal with going through this. How would you say is that introspection journey?
I think I realized how much of my own identity was tied to being married and tied to building what the perfect life is. And I think it's even being able to talk about it now, it's not something I would have openly spoken about before. It's acknowledging that that does not define my worthiness or who I am today or who I will be in the future, you know. Gave it my best run, didn't work out, you know. And I think it's the ability to forgive myself, learn from it, celebrate the things that I gained from it. Also, celebrate the fact that I co-parent amazingly with my ex-husband.
Amazing.
And take my own learnings from it. The big essence of it was, I am not a failure because I got divorced.
Yes.
That is like the essence of it.
You're touching on something so valid, because there is such a stereotype where many women feel, I've gone through a divorce and now there's no hope, there's no future, and nobody's going to ever look at me or be interested in me. And that, to your point, that element of worth and rebuilding your worth and rebuilding your confidence to even put yourself out there is a lot of work.
It is. And it's also a realization of, like, how much value I had put, and society does as well, on being married. Do you know, like, that, like, so much value of who you are is attributed to that. And it's like separating myself from that.
Yeah, I mean, that is so true. I'm reading a book, Woman Who Likes to Dance with Wolves. Mm-hmm. Every 10 pages, I have to put it down and I go, oh my gosh, this is fascinating. And it talks about, there's a part that I read that really fascinated me where women used to be so wise and, you know, in the history of time and mm-hmm. all these fairy tales that we learn from, they would change over time mm-hmm. through religions and people that try to change the narrative and change the story and how it's changed over a period of time and this inner revolution that women go through. It's a beautiful book, highly recommend it. But something that really fascinates me about that book is just recognizing as a woman, rediscovering yourself and that you're not property mm-hmm. and that you are fortified and can stand on your own 2 feet. And yeah, I think there was many, many years ago where women would wear clothing on their backs and the clothing that they wore was bought for them that they didn't mm-hmm. even feel that belonged to them. Mm-hmm. So I think this element of also being economically contributing to society, what a great example for your daughter mm-hmm. to see you studying a PhD. Now, let's get into that. So, listen, let me tell you, during the pandemic, I did my postgraduate diploma in management practice with Henley Business
during
School.
During the pandemic,
with a syndicate. It was very rough.
That is intense.
It was very rough. And that time, everything was going wrong and everything in my life. And it was 2 years of that. And then this thing and a syndicate. Anyway, hard work and so forth. But what I did realize is the pressure that it puts on your household.
Yeah.
It is not fun and easy because you've got assignments to get in. You've got to understand and grasp things. Talk me through the PhD. What did you study? And let's take the story from there. Take me through your career journey and how that all interlinks.
So I came from Durban, went to Wits, my alma mater. Absolutely love Wits.
Oh, I love
it. It completely changed my life experience from being at an all-girls school for 12 years of my life. I went two different schools, but all girls, to coming to Joburg, to going to Wits, to staying on campus at Res, and my Res was a co-ed Res. I mean, like, my life was completely different in Joburg to what it was in Durban. Okay. I studied, and I think education has been something that's formed a big part of my identity. I could never decide between psychology and marketing, so I majored in both, but ended up following the psychology route. But I always knew that I wanted to study further, so went into the world of work, and I was really lucky that I did my studies in my master's year on research at MultiChoice. So I got into MultiChoice to do my internship and had an absolutely amazing experience. I mean, a lot of the HR professionals I know now come out of that internship program at MultiChoice, and it just a really good training ground. Mm. From there, after 5 years, I went into financial services. And in financial services, I think what I realized is often I was the only woman at the table. I was the only woman of color at the table, and I was always the youngest.
Sure.
And in those contexts, women are often in support services. So the woman is the finance or the HR or the marketing, and the people who do the front office pieces in terms of investment banking or private banking, etc., are white males. Mm. And so being raised by this phenomenal black woman who told me that I could be in any context, which allowed me to find myself into that space, I was just inspired to do my PhD around women in the workplace. Mm. So I did it through UJ, and I did a study on understanding women in executive positions. What were their stories? How did they get to where they were? So I interviewed 10 women at the C-suite level. And then I did a survey as well to understand how do other people perceive them and what are the different characteristics that are attributed to black women versus white males. And so trying to compare, what are the attributes that are given to black women versus other individuals? And I think coming out of my PhD, a lot of it resonated with me. Like one of the first things that really resonated with me is in those situations for those women, when they made significant career transitions, it often involved a coach who pushed them into that situation when they did not believe they were worthy or ready for a transition. I could relate to that. At Nedbank, there was a role. I didn't apply. I was approached to apply. I got the job. I would never have thought I was worthy for the job. Second thing is that although there were so few Black women in senior positions, they didn't network with each other or know each other very well.
Sure.
So again, just how powerful networking is, which men do really well, networking and creating opportunities for themselves. How do we as women use that as our superpower to create more opportunities?
Absolutely.
And then being the only one in a senior role and a lot of pressure to be able to mentor and develop others, people take it in different ways. Some work extra hard to make sure that they're pulling other young women up so that there's more diversity. Others are quite focused on, there's a lot of pressure on me and I'm like doubling down to make this successful. So there's just a lot more pressure on those women to either build others up or to maintain this credibility so that you don't lose what you've built for yourself.
I find that very interesting because I've also heard a lot, and I really want to get to also to the journey and the 10 months that really shaked up your life. But I want to understand, because this conversation comes up a lot about especially women of color, how they are experiencing a bigger responsibility within corporate to maintain a certain persona. Please explain that a little bit more for the audience that we can have a better understanding.
I think the challenge is finding yourself in a position where you are the only Black woman. You face the dichotomy of people questioning if you're really worthy to be in that position or if you're window dressing. And then when you're in the position, you've got to work doubly hard to prove your credibility and worth. You have your own questions about your own worthiness, but you also have to dispute or dispel other people's perceptions of yourself. And then I guess there are people who are looking at you like, are you a team player? Are you pulling other women up? Are you creating other opportunities? Which is there space for all of us at the table? And how many of us can we build at the table? I think part of the challenge is we can't do it alone, right? When I listen to these women's stories, it's the mentors that they had, the coaches that they had, their bosses, a lot of them who are white males, who helped them develop. And so if we're going to look at this as a transformation journey that Black women must face on their own to create transformation, it won't work. It's something that everybody needs to come to the party to, because you need that sponsor, you need that coach, you need those people to also create opportunities.
Sure. And it's so insightful. It makes so much sense, especially with, you know, with BEE. You can sometimes, you know, you can hear conversations. There's a lot of bias around it. So I can understand the huge responsibility on women of color on their shoulders.
I do want to say to you, asked about the PhD journey itself on a personal level.
Yes.
When I went to UJ to start my PhD, they did like this 1 week, like an orientation. And I was so passionate. I was like, I will do this PhD in 2 years. I will not do it in 4 years. I will do it in 2 years. I will, like, I'm going to smash it out the park. Life happened. Like, to study, to raise a newborn child, to do a PhD. Oh, I am so,
you're brave.
I am so grateful to my supervisor. Like, there are times where I wanted to give up and he wouldn't let me. He was like, you are finishing this. And in the end, it took me 7 years.
Not, oh, yeah, it comes a Wonder Woman story.
Not the 2 years I had it.
But you did it.
It took me 7 years, but I did it. In the end, and there were periods in between where I took a break. In the end, I was waking up in the morning, going to work, coming home around 6 p.m., having dinner, sleeping, waking up at 11, doing my PhD until 2 in the morning, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. I was doing it on weekends. In the end, it was just grit. It was grit. And sure, when they say your supervisor is with you on the PhD journey, it really is the journey for both of you. So,
wow. Yeah. So talk me through that 10 months that shattered you.
It's actually quite a crazy way in which it started, right? So I was at the point in my life where I had received this amazing job and I was going to join the Gates Foundation. And towards the end of 2021, we got a phone call that my dad had been ill. He'd been ill during the week. They were worried about him. And then they sent him to the hospital on Friday. Now, the backstory is that my dad had had prostate cancer before, but for the year before that, the year leading up to that, he had said, he's clean, everything is fine. And so we were not worried about that at all. Went into the hospital on the Friday. My sister and I were still talking about traveling to Durban, and we got feedback that we need to get to Durban a lot sooner. I remember I was actually in my bedroom with my friends in the room with me as I was packing, and I was like, I don't know if I'm packing to go home for the weekend or if I'm packing for my dad's funeral. Like, it was just, and I got the phone call right there and then, and doctors don't call you. My dad had passed away. Mm. My mother at the time had Alzheimer's. So I had about 3-4 years leading up to that of preparing for my mother's death. So that I was kind of ready for. My dad's death completely knocked me. I hadn't wrapped my mind around my father dying because he seemed fine, etc. Went home, did the funeral. I think what was great then was I hadn't started working at the Gates Foundation, but the director I was going to support actually phoned me to pay condolences. And I thought, wow, like I haven't even started and they're being so supportive. That was the start of the crazy 10 months. So that was my dad passed away at the end of 2021. And then 2022, 2 months later, my dad's sister passed away, my aunt Mbali. And then 2 months later, my uncle passed away, Temba. My aunt Mbali had health issues, so it was difficult. But again, at least there was still a sign. It's so weird now, like I hold on to the fact now that there's like a sign somebody might die, you know, like it gives you a reprieve or a chance to mourn or reconcile or close things with those people. Oof, you're gonna make me cry. And then my uncle Temba passed away. My uncle Temba was living in my parents' home. It was in the evening. A vagrant came onto the property. They stabbed him in the neck. And so my brother was calling all of us. He took a video. We all saw the video. We were trying to get him to go to the hospital. He didn't make it. By the time the ambulance came, he had passed away. And I think what happened to me progressively between like December and like May, in that period, you go through the process of planning the funeral, the mourning, etc. But I was falling apart internally. Mm. And I thought that I could cope, but it took me time to realize what an impact that had had on me. I remember for my uncle's funeral, my sister came to my house and she literally stood next to me and said, pack your suitcase. I think that's how emotionally I was, just like another funeral. And June that year, I took a break. I had to admit defeat. I had to admit that I needed help, that this had gone beyond just sadness to a point where I was not able to cope and I needed a break from my life. And that was really hard. Again, coming back to that notion of failure, having to say, guys, I'm not making it. I'm not making it. I need help, and I don't need baby help. I need real help, and being able to step away from my life and get that help. A driving force of that as well was my daughter, my 8-year-old daughter, Bonolo, because I could see the impact my depression, my pain was having on her. Sure. I could see that she was looking at me and she herself was feeling the turmoil. And I think what's incredibly brave of her is at such a young age, she had the words to be able to say it. Like, she would cry and be like, I miss grandpa. And, you know, watching your child experience that and also know that you are grappling with it is part of what made me seek help. I got the help that I needed. I started to pull my life back together. And in a way, I thought I was on the right path. Things were starting to build up. And then in September that year, it was a Friday. I was working downstairs in my study. I got a phone call. I got a call from my mom's nanny upstairs. I ended my call. I went upstairs. And my mother was dying. It's so weird. I had spent so many years thinking about what it would feel like when my mother died, that it was so different when she did pass. I was incredibly grateful that it was in my home, that my brother and I were with her through that time. And she passed away in my home. We were with her when she passed. It felt completely different to the other deaths. It was seeing my mother. It was seeing my mother no longer in pain. I had watched my mother lose us over time, not know me, not know my daughter. So her health deteriorates. So my mother's passing was incredibly painful, but I felt a sense of relief for the pain that she was in. And yeah, closed out 2022, just a completely changed person. And I had the opportunity at work. We've got an event that happens every May. And one of the things that they do at that event is have a session where staff get to come and tell their stories. And I had witnessed it the year before, watched it online, and I'd seen the safety created and how people felt they could vulnerably open up and share their stories. And so I went on stage and I told my story. I never thought I would tell the whole organization my story.
Right.
Stand in front of them, be bare, be emotional. But I think that piece of it was part of my healing. That telling my story was me tearing down the mask of I'm fine at work and allowing other people to see that I'm not fine. I'm really not fine. And that it's okay to not be fine. It's okay to ask for help. And I was taken aback by how many people reached out to me and said, my mother or my father has Alzheimer's, or, oh my gosh, I had a really rough year. And I think that has helped me get to where I am today. It's given me permission to speak about it. I don't think I would have ever stood in front of people and said, I have depression. Yeah, do you know? Yeah. I, for a long time, that was something that was just for me. And now it's, no, we all go through difficulties. It's naming it, getting the support you need. That's the important part.
Yeah. And also putting one foot in front of the other. I mean,
every single day, constantly.
I mean, like, here is some tissue. But I mean, I think just listening to your story, and every time I listen to your story, I get so overwhelmed by emotion because, you know, if we just had to sit with that for a moment, the audience, remember, Sane is a trained psychologist. She knows how the inner brain and how to get yourself through difficult times, what she needs to do and how to journal. And I don't know if you've ever read that book, My Stroke of Insight. It is this woman, she's a brain scientist, and then she has the stroke and she writes a book of everything that happened in her mind as she recalled it as a brain scientist in her head while she's having a stroke. And I think to myself, what was that inner dialogue, that inner journey like, being a trained psychologist and going through probably the most traumatic time and having a career where you have to be strong for everybody around you and support and hold them through their transitions and what they're going through. What was that like?
Sure. I think we mentioned this earlier that, like, the shoemaker's kids have no shoes. Yes. I'm always surprised by, like, how I can have such great coaching conversations with people. Then I'm like, I should coach myself. Like I should really apply these skills on myself. I think I was so in it. Like yeah. I was so emotionally in it. I was so deep in the depression, so deep in the pain that even my asking for help was realizing that I can't do it on my own. It was a sign of desperation. And I think you can intellectually have the tools, but when you are in the trenches, in that deep, like difficult space, it's quite different to be able to use those tools on yourself. And I think what other people think also like really plays on your mind. I had just started a new role. They were incredibly supportive, but I was thinking like, am I proving myself within my new role? I want to show up a certain way. And so the dichotomy of I want to show up and I don't want to let people down with also I'm struggling and I need help. Balancing that is also very difficult. I think I can speak for myself and I'm sure other people do as well. We often put the needs and priorities of what other people need ahead of ourselves to our own detriment. And as hard as it is, learning to say there's a boundary here, I need a bit of space, I need a bit of help, has been the hardest thing, but the most empowering thing.
You know, something that's just coming to mind, we've heard of many research studies in our different cultures where some people don't go to psychologists or it's not accepted norm to see a psychologist. You have to go to the minister or to the pastor. I mean, is there a difference in what that journey could be like for a person that doesn't get the help from a psychologist? I'm not saying that one's wrong and one's right, but I mean, what is your perception on people that think that going to a psychologist is a bad thing?
I did it all. I used all the tools in the toolbox.
Gotcha.
I did not think that the Western tool or the traditional tool is better than the other. I said, anything anyone will give me, I will take. So I was seeing the psychologist and the psychiatrist. On the other side, I was doing traditional things with my family, seeing inyanga of the family. There was this incredible sense of just wanting to get to the root cause of the pain and everything and using whatever mechanism is available. So I can safely say that for me personally, I don't have a bias. I used it all. I mean, in our culture, when you give thanks or when you have umsebenzi or you do something, we slaughter and then you get ispandla, which is from the animal that you've slaughtered and you wear it around your wrist. And in my culture, you wear it until it falls off. So you can't take it off. And I was wearing a spandla. I mean, I would never have been that girl. Never. That's just not me. I was that girl. I went overseas with it. I went to Amsterdam with it. I was just this is where I am in my life at the moment. And my healing, my getting to my root, that became more of a priority.
I love that. And, you know, I almost feel that we're moving into a time as well, especially post-pandemic, where people are really, like even the cuisines that people are eating, people really want to get back to their roots. And I think there's something so beautiful and so powerful about really embracing where you come from. And there's something so powerful and comfortable about that. But, I mean, your story doesn't end here, right?
Yeah.
You go now and you do this massive talk and you're busy, busy, busy. And then what happened next?
So at the end of last year, I think there's a misnomer. Let me take a step back. I think there's a misnomer that like when you build your life and you get to a good place, you think it'll stay like that for a while.
Yes.
So like sometimes I feel like I talk about what a rough year 2022 was, as if it will stay there. But it doesn't. Life doesn't look at you and be like, well done, you got through it. That's all the hurdles we've got for you. We're done now.
So true.
So at the end of last year, I went to the theater with a friend. And as we were leaving the theater, there was a little bit of a ramp, like a baby ramp. And I slipped on the ramp and I fell on my butt. I was like, ooh, my butt is sore, but okay. Continued, went out. Then I woke up the next morning. I was like, no, man, this is not a baby fall. Let me go to the hospital. Went to Santa and Mediclinic with my partner. And they run all the tests. And then the doctor comes in. She asks him to step out. So now I'm like, and then the doctor says to me, women of a certain age, once you are of childbearing age, we automatically run a pregnancy test. You're pregnant.
Wow.
I actually don't know what happened in that moment. I think I was borderline hysterical. Like, I was crying and holding her. But after, it was the sheer shock of it. It was the sheer shock of, like, how am I pregnant? And she's like, based on the test, you look like you're 5 weeks pregnant. You're fine. Did you know? I was like, no, I did not know. But I've got a daughter. I've always wanted another child. I tried for a while. I couldn't fall pregnant. So this was like a surprise, a beautiful surprise. I was happy. Once the hysteria had left my body, I realized I was happy. My partner came in. He was incredibly happy. Started planning the journey, started the doctor's appointments. And then I lost the baby. Mm. I think... Ugh, we were at a music festival in Pretoria, and also that really sucks when you're away and you can only see your gynae like 2 or 3 days later, and you feel the process starting. And yeah, I lost the baby.
I'm sorry.
I think I didn't know. It was a whirlwind. I didn't know I was pregnant. I found out I was pregnant. I lost the baby. It took me like such a long time to wrap my mind around that and actually mourn that. And I kept saying, no, I'm okay. I'm okay. And then eventually I had to actually mourn it and be like, no, I'm not okay. And it also made me realize that I really want another child.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. And you're trying?
Trying.
Enjoy that moment. That's the best part. Just keep on trying. But I mean... I almost feel as if the resilience you built from all the previous deaths that happened almost made this one manageable.
Yeah.
Is that maybe a right way of putting it?
I think what the other experiences have taught me is that I don't have to suffer alone or suffer in silence.
Mm.
And by speaking about it, by asking for help, by not being afraid to say, I'm hurting, I think that helps with going through the process.
Yeah, it's so profound. I mean, your resilience is something else. And, you know, I mean, I mentioned to you when my father died, it took 2 years for me really to catch up what's going on. Because I mourned a father I didn't have, not the father I had. And I actually thought it's not going to be. But it was there. And that was just going through one death. Mm. I mean, you've gone through that. But also something I find that is also traumatic is seeing a loved one, for example, with dementia, because you lose them twice. It's different. And I think many people don't realize that it's a double mourning. It's not a single one.
I think with my mother, that was the dementia years were the hardest. Mm. They were the absolute hardest. My mother and I were very close. So to be with my mother and my mother not know who I am, she had started being ill when I got married. And for my sister's wedding, she was extremely involved. Like, that was who my mother was. Like, my sister had a custom dress made. We went for all the dress fittings. And then when I was getting married, my mother wasn't interested. Like... Mm. We didn't know at the time, right? That was the start of her illness. And that impacted my experience of getting married. Like, that played on me. And then obviously when I found out she was sick, I understood why she wasn't there. But I struggled with that a lot. I also struggled with the fact that my mother didn't know who my child was. My mother didn't know my daughter. But perhaps a reprieve at the end is that when my mother moved in with me, my daughter got to spend time with my mother. So my daughter got to meet, enjoy my mother. She used to wake up in the morning, go greet her, go to school, come home, rush up to see my mother. If I didn't wake up and like go greet my mother, she'd come to my room and get me. She'd put makeup on her, style her. So in a way, it was my daughter finding my mother and that which was really special. And even if she didn't name it as my daughter, she would ask Ipingani, which is like, where's the little child? So I think I got healing in the fact that they were able to spend time together. Mm. And my daughter got to know my mother.
And you and your daughter have an incredible relationship. I mean, she's got it all.
Feisty.
She has got it all. She's fierce feisty, and feisty, resilient. Like, we got to meet her briefly, and I see all of the social media posts and how and her makeup skills. I mean, she's
so
like
good.
She's got to do my makeup soon. I want to have those colorful eyes. Like, oh my gosh! Like, who did she learn that from?
I promise you. God gives you, gives it to you right back at you. I think when I was younger, I was always just like challenging my parents and like, you know, outspoken, etc. And I got that back. Hey? She is so smart and confident and knows what she wants and just goes for it. Like, it's so amazing watching her grow, but also watching how she challenges me. And we're also so different. Like, she's a girly girl. She does makeup. She's like, what fit am I going to wear this morning?
Wow.
I'm like, put on gym gear and sneakers and let's go, hun. She's like, no ways. I am not wearing that. So, gosh, parenting her is also like refinding myself in its own way.
It's deposit. Oh, I love it. No, but I mean, this is also for me a beautiful end. Not end, because our stories are always continuing and evolving and unfolding. Mm-hmm. What I truly love is that your daughter also can see the resilience in mommy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in all aspects, from studying, getting through a difficult time to get divorced, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And then more importantly, as a young child, also to experience so much death around you must have been very hard for her. What advice can you give to mothers that have experienced things like that? How did you manage that?
Sure. That was the hardest. Having, you know, we would just be sitting and my daughter would cry and say how sad she feels. And that was so difficult. And I think what got us through that, and I try to continue to do, is just to speak openly, to just allow her the space to say, I feel sad, or I don't feel okay, to ask her if she needs help. That open dialogue, I think it also hasn't been easy, because as part of my own personal healing and conversations with my therapist is acknowledging how my going through the pain has impacted her. So speaking to my daughter about like how she feels about that and how she's felt about that period, it's been hard. But I think we were in a generation where perhaps speaking up about your feelings and being open about it, you kind of like got on with it. And I'm trying to create the space where we can speak openly about things so that it's not like us where I'm talking about my childhood in therapy now, as opposed to having had the opportunity to talk about those things with my parents.
Wow.
But it's incredibly hard, because it's also a mirror to yourself sometimes of things that you don't want to see.
Yeah.
But I want her story to be different. I want her to have different opportunities.
I love that. You know, something that I really learn from you throughout this experience is this undefined era, right? It is this era of, you can't name it. It doesn't have a lot of excitement in it. It's almost you have to sit with that pain and you have to sit with that emotion. And I think once you recognize you're going through this undefined era, I think one of the other things is the integration.
Yeah.
Like getting a little bit better, making sure that you do, because I mean, when you pull yourself out of society, when you've gone through a depression, it's very hard, and I don't know if you've experienced it, but it's very hard to put yourself back into the room and to have the same conversations you used to have with your friends and you used to have with people. It's almost like you have to relearn those skills. Did you find that there was some integration elements that you needed to work on?
I think I always lived in the black or the white, but not the gray. So it was either I was good at something or I wasn't. I was doing something or I wasn't. And I've had to learn to give myself a little bit more grace. I think what it's made me do is reflect on my life and be like, why am I doing this thing? Am I doing this thing because of what it looks like externally? Or am I doing this thing because it really brings me pure joy? And so I think it's made me hone in on trying to discover what really makes me happy, what makes me healthy holistically, and focusing my energy more on that. Previously, I think I focused more on achieving my goals. I think now it's shifted a little bit and it's, am I happy? Am I healthy? Am I in a good space? Are the things that I'm doing rewarding me, enriching me personally? Do I feel emotionally healthy? So I think that's what the shift is. And it doesn't mean that these two things are like mutually exclusive, that you can't have both. But sometimes you can do these things and forget about yourself in the process. I don't think I've got the luxury to forget about myself now. And I'm so, so conscious of the impact I have on my daughter. Because I think about how much of who my mother was drove and helped me become who I am. I'm more conscious of what I'm doing and what it means for myself, as opposed to doing what I think I should be doing at this stage.
Wow. I want to say, first of all, thank you for sharing your story and being so open and vulnerable. And I feel that this could be so helpful to all the women listening in. I want to ask you a closing question. How was the journey like to learn how to trust yourself? Because trusting your intuition, trusting that what you're doing is the right thing, overcoming the doubts, but also the way you view the world, surely after an event like this and everything that you've gone through must have changed everything in how you view culture, society, the news. I don't know. Can you just give us a parting thought of what trust means to you?
I think this is a combination of being achievement-oriented and Aries. All of those, like the melting pot, being the youngest in my family, having a mother who's like superwoman. A lot of it is about achieving the tough things, doing the big things. And sometimes you give away your own intuition, etc., to other people, and their validation becomes more important. Through this process, it's been the hardest to actually listen to myself and my voice and actually trust and believe that what I need is important, and that what I need right now and what I need to focus on right now supersedes everything else. And so perhaps it's a journey of learning to trust myself and learning to trust my needs and to listen to what I need spiritually, emotionally, physically. It's hard. I've realized how many external voices have been overpowering my thinking. Part of what it's also resulted in is cutting out and not doing things which I thought I was doing for the right reasons. But when I sat down and I had to like calibrate, what does this mean to me? Why am I doing it? It doesn't serve me. It might look good externally, but it doesn't serve me personally in terms of my own healing and growth, etc. So I'm learning to trust myself a lot more and that I know what I need.
Absolutely love it. Sana, I love you so much. You're just such, every time I'm with you, I'm just like, oh, yes, see, she's my sister.
You feel like home, Carmen.
Oh, feel like home. It's like my heart just warms up and I feel like I can really have such open conversations with you, and you make it normal and you make it feel inclusive, and
you create that space.
Yeah.
You create that space. I think even at the doing the speaking at work, etc., I speak in spaces where I can feel that it is a safe space. And I think that's something that you do incredibly well, to create the space to allow people to show up authentically as themselves.
Thank you. Well, I would like to say, here is to a fortified woman who is bringing trust back to herself and is fortifying herself for the amazing future that lies ahead of you. Well done. And I hope that each one of you that have listened into this episode can really see that our journeys are all interconnected. And when you are going through a tough time, just remember, trust yourself through the process. And remember, it's not going to be like that permanently. Things will change. It will get better. Thank you, Sunny.
Thank you, Pami.
Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.